All right. Good morning. Louder. Here we go. Good morning. It is good to be here. Good to be together, to worship together, and to give God thanks for all that He's done for us and continues to do for us, and to read His Word and to hear what He would have us to do with our lives. Today's lesson for this hour is titled Winning the Rat Race. Winning the Rat Race. You're probably familiar with that phrase, the rat race. I have distinct memories being young and hearing that phrase and not knowing exactly what it meant. And I got some strange image in my mind, probably from reading like the Pied Piper or something. But we're not talking about rats when we talk about the rat race. It's a phrase when we talk about that great struggle. It's the striving of life. It's relentless and it never ends. You're competing with yourself and with others and the whole world for first place. It's keeping up with the Joneses. It's wanting more and more, whether it's things or status or power. It's chasing the next promotion, the next degree, the next possession, whatever it might be. It's the pursuit of life that wears us out. Call it the rat race. It might surprise you this morning that of all places, the Bible has the answer, how to win the rat race. And that's what we're going to try and figure out this morning. And so we'll start with the question, well, how do you win? The relentless pursuit for more wealth, for more power, for more status or respect, for more, more, more. How do you win? We'll start to find our answer in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you want to turn in your Bibles there, the book of Ecclesiastes. This will be right after the book of Proverbs. It'll be near the very middle of our Bibles. The book of Ecclesiastes is a book of wisdom. It's written by a wise, wise man who's reflected on his life, who's sought life in pursuit of God, and he has advice to share. One of the best things that we can do in life, especially as we're on our younger years, is to learn from those who have gone ahead. There's a lot that can be gained in life experience, and that's a lot of what we see in the book of Ecclesiastes. We're going to read about a man who had everything, and he put life to the test. He wants to see what life is for, what is good in life. And with a man who has a lot more opportunity than many of us will ever know, he has some very good wisdom for us to share. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 12 begins this way. It says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that's done under heaven. And it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. We're introduced in verse 12 to the preacher. That's the only thing that he goes by in Ecclesiastes. It's the person who's telling us what he's learned. It's the wise man. And he says, I searched with my heart in verse 13 to know by wisdom everything that's done under heaven. He says, I want to know what the right thing to do is. I want to know how to live a wise life, a good life. And how many of us here can appreciate the goal and say, well, I want to know how to live a good life. You know, I want to do what's wise and right. And this man's going to share his wisdom with us. He tells us in verse 14, and he will say this over and over in the book. He doesn't wait to give you his conclusion. That's part of what's helpful about the book of Ecclesiastes. Some books, you start reading it, and you don't know how it's going to end, and so you got to wait the whole time to the end of the book. Some people, when they read a book and they don't know how it ends, they start by reading the end of it. And there's no recourse for that. I don't know why anyone would do that. But the book of Ecclesiastes does not leave you wondering. It doesn't say, you know, what's his answer going to be? What's the final evaluation? He will tell you over and over and over throughout the point of life. What do we find as the measure of life? It says, under the sun, it is vanity. This is vanity. Emptiness. It's vain. Empty is a good way to think about it. And he's going to go into more detail about this. But he says, I said in my heart, in verse 16, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were in Jerusalem before me. My heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I applied my heart to know wisdom and madness and folly, and I perceive that it's striving after wind. Have you ever tried to catch the wind in your hand? You drive and you have the windows down and you put your hand out the window and you're waving it up and down. You try and catch it. Have you ever succeeded? The preacher says, this is what life is. It is striving after wind. You can chase anything that you want and you're never going to catch it. You're never going to find success or happiness in a bottle. You can't buy it at the store. And he's going to give us these examples here. And so with the wise man, the preacher, who had tested everything, he wants to see what's going on. This is how he goes through it. There's three things here in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 where the preacher says, I went for it. I searched for it here and here and here. What is the reason that we're here? How do you have a wise, good life? And over, he's told you his conclusion. I didn't find it. And this is where he starts. Ecclesiastes 2, the beginning of the chapter. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, and my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. He wants us to know that he didn't just cut loose. He says, I'm going to try just enjoying my life. And he's not just sowing his wild oats. This is some kind of experiment. He says, I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm going to do as much good and pleasing things as I can in my life to see if it's enough, if it's happy, if it's good, if it's wise. And so look at what he does in verse 4. I made great works. I built houses, planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves. I had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who were before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem, and all my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, and for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. He had it all. He did whatever he wanted. In verse 11, I considered all that my hands had done, the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. There's nothing to be gained under the sun. This is his analysis of living a life just to enjoy it. We hear that as popular advice, don't we? Just got to enjoy your life. You got to unwind a little bit. Take things too seriously. Just enjoy yourself. And many of us do not have all the opportunities that someone like Solomon would have. Because not all of us are the richest man on earth, right? So we enjoy things as much as we can, maybe, or within our means, and we wonder if that's going to make us happy. But Solomon, he had no limit. He was the richest man in the world in his time, just absolutely loaded with cash. And he says, let's see what happens. Can I get enough stuff? And you look at all the things he's done, and it's things that we know are admirable. I mean, these are things that we see the goodness of them. He's got plenty of houses. He's building gardens and parks and ways to water them. I mean, has anyone ever been to a botanical garden that a big city puts together? It's like perfectly arranged, and they've got trees and plants from all over the world, and not a leaf is out of place. It's like the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. Solomon says, I've got plenty of those. He's got all the entertainment he could want. He's got servants who wait on his every need. He's got a million wives, you know. He's got everything he ever wanted. And he gets to the end of it, and he says, no one has ever had more than me. Is it enough? Solomon, did that make you happy? Did that give you purpose? He says, it's vanity. It's not enough. How do you win the rat race? How do you get to first place in the world? It's not by getting more stuff than everyone else. It's not by living your life just to enjoy it. He tested life and he said it's empty. And we can see this not just with Solomon. You know, Solomon lived a long, long time ago. But you look at the world today, it's the richest people in the world. Talk about the billionaires in the world. Do we look at those people and say, you know, they're well-adjusted, they have figured it out. They are purposeful, and they've got it figured out. You can have as many yachts as you want, mansions, houses on whatever islands. And it's like, that's not enough to make it for you. It's not enough. You continue searching for more. So how do you win the rat race? It's not by the most stuff. Solomon turns his attention elsewhere in verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. I saw that there's more gain in wisdom than in folly, just like there's more gain in light than in darkness. A wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks around in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to them all. I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies, just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after the wind. Well, if you can't win the rat race by enjoying yourself the most, having the most stuff, Solomon says, maybe the secret is to become wise, is to have the most wisdom, to be the sharpest, whether it's the most educated or the most wise in the way you live your life. And he says in the final equation, there's one problem. You notice in verse 14, he says, it's better to be wise than a fool. You can live a better life if you are paying attention to what you're doing and trying to do what's best. But he says there's one thing that makes everything pointless in the end. Everyone goes to the grave, and everyone dies. So whether you've lived a wise life or a foolish life, in your lifetime it's better to be wise, but in the end, it does not matter if death is all there is. And you can picture it here. He says, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why have I spent all this time being wise? I mean, imagine there's two men who are neighbors, and one of them is straight-laced and careful, and he tries to be wise in everything he does. And he mows his yard every week, and it's trimmed, and it's cut nice. He reconciles his checkbook every single day. He invests his money well. He spends time with his family and with his kids. He tries to guide his kids to go to good schools and get good jobs. He is involved with the local community. And at the end of his life, he's surrounded by friends and family, and he dies, and they lay him in the cemetery. Lived a good life, wise man, right? Did the best that he could. Let's say that his neighbor is a fool and wastes all of his time and wastes all of his money and has had six wives and doesn't live with any of them anymore. And whatever extra money he makes, he buys them scratch tickets and all this. And he dies with no one around him. No one seems to remember it. And maybe they'll put his grave right next to the wise man in the cemetery. Give it a few years, and you'll walk by that cemetery, and it's two names. And no one knows those people. And maybe you've heard about those people, but you don't know what their voice sounded like. You don't know how they walked, or what their life was like, or what they enjoyed. They're forgotten. You can be wise and make yourself a good life while it's here. In fact, you should. But if you're thinking that if I'm just careful enough, if I'm just wise enough, if I just play all my cards right, I'll have a good life and it'll be good in the end, you're wasting your time if you think that's going to be the solution to it all. Because it comes for all of us. You know, if I asked you, who was the wisest person in 1897? Who in the world knows? What do you know anything about 1897? The world forgets, and it will forget all of us. If you want to win the rat race, wisdom's not enough. It doesn't matter if you're the sharpest person or the smartest person or the most careful. In the end, the grave settles everything even. And so he has one more test. In verse 18, he says, I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of everything for which I've toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils under the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his works are a vexation, and even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. His conclusion in verse 24, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This I saw is from the hand of God, and apart from him, who can eat or have any enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after wind. And Solomon looks back on his life. He reflects on it. He said, I had more stuff than anyone else. I had more fun. I had more pleasure than anyone else. And he says, still, your heart does not rest at night. I was wiser than anyone. I had more wisdom. I did things carefully. I did them the right way. Solomon still laid in bed at night and couldn't sleep. He hadn't found peace or fulfillment in these things. And so he turned to all the work that he'd done, and he said, what did I do all this for? Maybe someone will come after me and they won't appreciate it. How many times have you seen in the news or something where there's some great millionaire and they're a self-made man and they started with nothing and they've built all this up and they leave it to their kids and their kids just become entitled. They didn't work for anything and they've always had everything they wanted and they waste all their money in a few years. Solomon says, what's the point? Why do I spend all my life trying my hardest, striving after nothing that I can't even hold in my hand? No, work is empty too. You can work as hard as you want, but it won't make you the winner. And at the end of your life, it won't be success. It won't be fulfillment. Stuff is empty. Wisdom is empty. Work is empty. So how do you win the rat race? These are like the best ways you can go, right? These are the primary ways of running the rat race. Have more stuff, be more educated, be at the top of the hill. He says, none of it works. And for Solomon, the preacher, as he looks at his life, he uses the phrase under the sun over and over and over. Life under the sun. He says, if what we see around us, if what we can see in the world, if the earth is all that there is, it is pointless. It is vain. And when we die, that's it, and no one will ever remember you. But the good news this morning is that there is a heaven above the earth. And there is a God in that heaven who reigns forever and who will raise his people from the dead, those who are faithful. And so for us, toiling is not vanity. Wisdom is not vanity. How do you win the rat race? Quit. That's how you win the rat race. You quit trying to compete with everything else in the world. You quit trying to win the prizes and the rewards that the world promises to give you because it will never be enough. You can live your whole life chasing a career and thinking, if I get settled enough, if I get high enough in my job, I can leave a really good thing for my family. And for what? One day your kids are going to leave their money to someone else and someone else and someone else. You'll be someone's great-great-great-grandfather, and they won't know you. These prizes, they don't last. These rewards. You know, you run on the rat race, but it's a treadmill. You don't go anywhere. I do not like running on treadmills. I like running. I think it's fun, but the treadmill is horrible. Nothing moves. You're not making any progress. The rat race is just like this. This pursuit of, if I could just get the next step, I'll be there. You know, I will have made it. It will never make it. There's no treasure at the end of the road because the road never ends. And so many people flood down that road. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, the way is broad and easy that leads to destruction, and many go by it. It's the rat race, trampling over each other just to get more and more and more. But they're still empty. You know, you win the rat race by quitting, by refusing to chase the next landmark, the next title, the next promotion, the next big house or boat or whatever it might be. Give up the chase to look for a true reward. It's the example of Christ in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 in verse 9. This is the way that Paul describes the work of Jesus. It's one little verse. It's one that's worth committing to memory. It encapsulates everything about what Jesus does in the gospel. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9 says, "You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich." Jesus never played the rat race. He wouldn't play Satan's games when he was tempted. Jesus did not live a fabulous life like King Solomon. Jesus did not have everything he could ever want in this life. He wasn't rich and powerful, but Jesus lived a life that is eternally true and good and wise. He had plenty of enemies in his lifetime, didn't have very many comforts. He said he was rich, but he gave it up so that others could become rich by his poverty. Jesus says, store up your treasures in heaven, not on earth. If the things that we want most in this life can be destroyed by moth or rust or forgotten on a bookshelf, it's not worth spending your life for. He says, seek the true eternal reward. It's the way that the Apostle Paul speaks about it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, if you'll turn there, we'll read this just briefly. We seek a goal that is imperishable. It does not fade. Eternal life with God. The great problem for Solomon in Ecclesiastes is that death makes everything void. What's the point of living a good life if you're just going to die and no one's going to remember you? What's the point of having all this stuff if you can't keep it? Solomon says, death is the problem, and Jesus says, I have come to fix it. That on the other end of the grave, there is a life that never ends for those who are faithful, who live lives of submission to God. And so when Paul commends the Christian life, this is what he says in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run like you might obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I don't box like one beating the air. I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Paul says, you know, you live your whole life striving for things, and we see the example of athletes in our world. They make sacrifices. They work hard. Even the top of the list. You know, you think of Olympic athletes. Your name goes down in history, right? You're one of the, I was an Olympic athlete, you know. Won however many golds this year, whatever it might be. And they work hard. They train for years and hours. They make sacrifices, all sorts of life sacrifices to win that prize. And one day, you know, in a few decades, those medals that they spent their life for are going to go up for sale on eBay. They're going to be in a box somewhere because someone's grandma was an Olympic athlete. It's like, why did you spend your life for that? It will not last. Paul says people discipline themselves and work hard for these trophies, and we think it's reasonable in this life. He says, should you not work hard for the eternal reward? For the say-so of God to say, this is my son. This is my servant that I am well pleased with. Enter into the joy of your master. Is that not worth fighting for? Working hard for? If athletes will win a trophy that they put on a shelf, how much harder should we work for the crown of life which the Lord will give to us? There's one reward that the rat race cannot give. Eternity. There's only one who gives that reward. Our last reading today is 2 Timothy 4, verses 6 through 8. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. This is what our brother read for us just a moment ago. This is Paul's last letter. The Apostle Paul has lived a long, difficult life. And in 2 Timothy, he writes, awaiting trial in Rome. And not soon after he writes this letter, Paul is executed, finally. He's been arrested plenty of times, but this is the last time. And as he writes to Timothy, this man who he converted years ago and has known for so long, he knows he's at the end. And he says, in verse 6, I am already being poured out as a drink offering. The time of my departure has come, and I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. How do you measure Paul's life? He says the reward that he's been searching for all this time, he says, is the crown of righteousness. He wants God to look on him and say, this one is righteous. This one is one of mine. It's the only thing that Paul cares about. And how do you evaluate a life like Paul's? Would you wish that on you or on your family? As far as I can tell, Paul never got married, never had kids, grandkids. Spent a lot of his time traveling all over the world, in and out of prison, in front of courts all the time. Met people all over the place, never really settling down. And here at the end, Paul doesn't have a lot of friends around him. It's the sad part of chapter 4 here. He writes to Timothy saying, Timothy, please come soon. There's not many people here with me. You look at Paul's life and you say, he's an old man and he's dying alone. Now, I wouldn't want that for me or for my kids. But how does Paul look at his life? Paul met the Lord as an unbeliever on the way to Damascus. And the Lord opened his eyes and stood by him. When Paul ran all across the ancient world, meeting people and preaching the gospel, the Lord stood by him. When they drug him out of town and threw rocks at him, the Lord stood by him. When he met with believers that he loved and cherished, who had his very heart, the joy of the brotherhood, the Lord was there. And now as he sits in this cell, waiting for his last trial, the Lord is with him. And what does Paul say? Does he look back like Solomon, that rich, rich man, and say, it's all vanity? No, the old apostle says, victory. He says, this is it. I've kept the faith, and eternity is waiting for me. I just want to challenge you to reconsider how you value your life. it's fine and good to be settled. God gives us good blessings to enjoy in this life. But are we raising our kids and our grandkids to think that if they get a good education, if they get a good job and they are able to settle down and leave some for the next generation, that's how you make it? Are we telling them that that's the reward to seek? Are we only going to be content with our lives if we can end with the things that we want, to live in the place that we want? What reward are you fighting for? What race are you running? There's one race that promises a lot of rewards and gives none of them, not even participation. Paul says, I have run my race. I kept the faith. There is nothing more important for our entire lives than keeping the faith. Paul says, eternity awaits, and my Lord is calling. Find the right reward, brothers and sisters. If we can help you with that this morning, we'd love to. You can come up to the front while we stand and sing our song.